Welcome, everyone, to the Guggenheim. Tonight's event is being presented, as you know, by the Associates Committee, and I'd like to extend a very special thank you to our co-chairmen, Jamie Zoki and Karen Gallagher, for all of the effort and the support that they give to this committee for this program, as well as the others that are put on throughout the day, or the year, excuse me. Our lecture, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, A History of the Guggenheim Museum, will begin with Peter Lawson Johnston, who will talk about the founding of the museum by his grandfather, Solomon R. Guggenheim. He will also highlight important phases of the institution's development over the past 50 years. Thomas Krenz, director of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation, will follow with an overview of ongoing projects and future goals for this internationally renowned museum of 20th century contemporary art. Peter Lawson Johnston graduated from the University of Virginia, majoring in philosophy in 1951. During his career, he has served as director on the boards of numerous companies, including Kennecott Copper. Currently, he is the chairman of Zemex, a mining company, director of McGraw-Hill, and chairman of the Harry Frank Guggenheim Foundation, which gives grants to those who shed light on man's relation to man. He is a trustee of his alma mater, the Lawrenceville School. He is a member of the Jeffersonian Restoration Advisory Board, the purpose of which is to restore Thomas Jefferson's academical village at the University of Virginia. And he has served as chairman of that board during the years of 1985 to 89. He is also a director of the Council for the United States and Italy. His able leadership as president of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation since 1969 has greatly benefited the public at large, who continue to enjoy the original works collected by Solomon, as well as the special editions which have been acquired over time. With very biased admiration, I introduce to you my father, Peter Lawson Johnston.
Rather biased introduction, I would say, too. I'm very proud to be introduced by my daughter, who has taken an enormous interest in this institution over a good many years, had much to do with starting our associates program, both here and in Venice, and is a very active trustee. I gave more this same lecture, more or less, at the instigation of my wife, Dee Dee, at the Colony Club some months ago, and I was so pleased when it was over that I threw away my notes, and so my daughter, Wendy, who asked me to do this, made me resurrect my notes. The last time, to the best of my knowledge, people did not pay to hear me talk, and I hope I can justify your expenditure. And with apologies to Ward Jackson, who has been sort of the Guggenheim historian over the years, this is a presentation, as Wendy said, of a colorful history of the family and our two museums. When I, from time to time, at a dinner party or wherever, people, I usually say I'm involved with the Guggenheim, and then if it comes to their attention that I'm president, they're usually quite surprised, and they ask me why. And I either say because Solomon Guggenheim was my grandfather, or if my mother had been my father, my name would have been Guggenheim. At any rate, this is a slide presentation. This is a picture of my grandfather, Solomon Guggenheim. His parents arrived from Switzerland in 1848. They were penniless. They settled down in Philadelphia. And I will tell you more about how they proceeded to succeed in life. He died in 1949, 10 years before this museum opened to the public, at the age of 88. I was 22 at the time. I remember him very fondly. He was a great raconteur. He loved to play golf. He loved to shoot. He loved to work at the office. I visited him many times with my mother. He had homes in Charleston, South Carolina, a lovely home on the Battery that Dick Jenneret of Donaldson, Lufkin, Jenneret now owns. He had a ranch in Idaho, a lovely place in Port Washington, Long Island, with a golf course where I learned how to play the game. And I'll tell you more about him later, but just suffice it to say that he and I had a very wonderful relationship as far as I was concerned. This is a picture of my mother. She was the youngest of my grandfather's three daughters. And to be very, very candid with you, Mom was much more interested in horses than she was in art. But she raised me following her divorce from my father. I was 3 years old and have very little recollection of that particular separation. One of the things, not knowing my father as I grew up, that made me sort of admire him without knowing him was that whenever I did anything wrong, she would always say, "You're just like your father." She served as a trustee here at the Guggenheim until she had a stroke. One of her cause celebres was over the question of who it was that brought Frank Lloyd Wright to my grandfather's attention. It's been commonly stated in John Davis's book and in other books about the Guggenheims that Hilla Rebbe, the Baroness Hilla Rebbe, was responsible. My mother always told me and everyone else that it was her mother, Irene Guggenheim. And by the way, this auditorium is named in her memory. Just to show you that I did have a father whom I did meet finally when I got out of the Army around 1947. He was from the Bovril, if you've ever heard of that horrible drink in England, a British family. My great-grandfather invented that horrible drink, and that was the family business. Dad attended Eton and was in both the British Home Guard and the American Army during World War II. And quite candidly, I don't know whether that's the British or an American uniform. When I was running the Excelsior Hotel in Rome as a sergeant in the Army, Lawrence Tibbett, whom some of you who are a bit older will remember was an opera singer, came to Rome, stayed at the Excelsior Hotel, and when I took him up to his suite, I asked him whether there would be anything else, and he said, "Yes, find me a chap by the name of Lawson Johnson." And I said, "Well, that's me." He said, "Well, I've just left Paris, and your father is a good friend of mine, and he's very eager to meet you. And when you meet him, and here's his address, I suggest you correspond. When you do meet him, he's a little sensitive over the fact that he's had five wives. And so don't dwell on that when you meet your father." So when I got out of the Army and came back to New York, the big day occurred at the Plaza Hotel, and we were to meet down in the Palm Court. I was very prompt, and an older gentleman sat next to me looking quite nervous, looking at his watch. And I said, "I beg your pardon, sir, but who are you waiting for?" And this fellow stood bolt upright, and he said, "It's none of your damn business." And it was not my father. But I've heard stories about the plaza since. But in any event, I did meet Dad, and he said, "By Jove, you've grown." And, you know, from the age of 3 to 20, you do that. But we went into the Oak Bar, and we had a scotch, several scotches. And thinking about his fifth wife, I said, "Dad, I understand that you have remarried." Pretty tactful, I thought. But anyway, he was a great guy, and he died about 10 years ago in Switzerland, where he lived for many years with his fifth wife. And by the way, he was married to her for 25 years. This is the genealogical chart. I told you that my great-grandfather, Meyer, came over from Switzerland. He married Barbara Meyer. This just happened to be her last name, no relation. And they settled down in Philadelphia, as I said, in 1848. And he and his father, until his father died, sold stove polish. And they were basically peddlers and furniture polish. And they were very successful at that. And Meyer and Barbara, Meyer is the fellow with the beard in the middle there, they had 7 sons and 2 daughters. And he was a tough taskmaster with his sons. And they were quite successful. I think they got into the lace business. And ultimately, Meyer invested in a silver mine in Leadville, Colorado. And the mine had been flooded, and he invested $25,000 in it, which was quite a lot of money back then. And to make a long story short, it was a great success, a bonanza. And the 7 sons got into the business, in the mining business. And there's a story about Meyer and his 7 sons gathering in the, perhaps it was in that office, and he passed out 7 sticks. And he handed each one of them a stick, and he said, "Break that stick," which they did. And then he put 7 sticks together, and he said, "Try to break them," and they couldn't. And the moral, of course, was if you stick together, you're going to do well. And they did. And they became known as the Copper Kings in mining in this country, and they got into diamonds and all sorts of things. They were very successful in the early 1900s. After they made their money, they decided to give some of the money back to the country that they'd grown up in, and formed quite a few foundations. The John Simon Guggenheim Foundation is probably the best known, gives grants to people in the arts and sciences. The Daniel and Florence Guggenheim Foundation did much in this country for aviation and rocketry. Pioneers, really. And in the case of Goddard in rocketry, when the United States government wouldn't support him, the Guggenheims did, and he was the father of rocketry in this country. The Murray and Leone Foundation was a dental clinic, which got so much competition from the public sector that folded not long ago. And then my grandfather, of course, formed the Solomon R. Guggenheim Foundation, which now operates this museum as well as the one in Venice. My sense of humor doesn't respond too enthusiastically to this cartoon, but and I wouldn't have included it, but I knew you'd be interested. But it was a cartoon that came out at the time when they were forming all these foundations. This is Eleanor, my grandfather's oldest daughter, my mother's older sister. and I'm now getting into the next generation. She was at the coronation of George VI in this picture. She left the United States and moved to England at a pretty early age, married the Earl of Castle Stewart, and lives to this day in Sussex, outside of London. I adore this woman. She's 93 years old. I never go to Venice without stopping in London and seeing her. My last visit, I said, "How are you getting along, Eleanor?" She said, "Well, sometimes I just sit and think." She said, "Come to think of it, sometimes I just sit." This is Peggy Guggenheim with Nicholas Elion, the young man in the middle, and an unidentified girlfriend. Peggy Guggenheim, of course, was Benjamin's daughter. Benjamin is the one of the Guggenheim brothers who went down on the Titanic. He's the one that said, "If I'm going to die, I'm going to die like a gentleman." He put on his black tie and went down like a gentleman. She was considered by the more conservative branch of the family, which was everybody but her, I guess, as sort of the hippie of those days. And she, in spite of her criticism, really, of the stodgy uncles in the United States, when her father died on the Titanic, she was the beneficiary of some trusts that the brothers got together and set up for her. She was never enormously wealthy, but these little trusts did help quite a bit. She wrote a book called Out of This Century way back then, and I can remember my mother and grandmother referring to the book as Out of My Mind. I'll say more about Peggy later. This is another picture of her with Jackson Pollock. This is a slide of Harry Guggenheim, also the next generation. He was Dan's son, my grandfather's nephew. He was my predecessor as president of this foundation. He was a wonderful man, as far as I'm concerned and as far as most people are concerned. He was ambassador to Cuba. He did much of what was done by that foundation, which focused on aviation. He was a great friend of Charles Lindbergh. And he was a perfectionist in everything that he did. He got into the racehorse business and the breeding line, and he to this day, most of the best horses, thoroughbreds, are the result of the breeding that he instituted. He won the Kentucky Derby. That was probably the highlight, with Dark Star that beat Native Dancer quite a few years ago. He had a tough time in the early part of his presidency of this foundation. He was dealing with prima donnas, Frank Lloyd Wright, James Johnson Sweeney, our second director. He had problems with the Baroness, Hilla Rebbe, who, as you know, I will speak of more later, but who really was responsible for the Guggenheim collection that my grandfather collected. His problems with the Baroness basically evolved from the fact that she really was not, she was brilliant. I think everyone agrees, she was a fabulous woman and what she did in the field of non-objective art and what she did for this institution. But I wouldn't call her a team player, and certainly not a professional director. And so after my grandfather died and she was the director, it was very, very difficult for the board to put up with her ups and downs. So anyway, Harry did have that responsibility. That's just another official portrait of him. Now, Hilla, whom I just mentioned, she was the daughter of a German military officer. This picture was taken at the Bauhaus in Dessau in 1930, and it shows on the left my grandfather, Hilla Rebbe Kandinsky, and my grandmother, Irene. Hilla was an artist, and she was a portrait painter, and she was introduced to my grandfather, perhaps to my grandmother's later regret, by my grandmother, and she did my grandfather's portrait. And during that process, she said, "You've been a big success in the mining world. Why don't you change and do something, be a success at something else?" And he became intrigued with non-objective art and her, not necessarily in that order. But the two of them really made many trips to Europe and started collecting madly. And as you know, we're famous for our Kandinsky collection, perhaps more than anything else that was acquired during that period. And she's totally responsible for that. I have always referred to her as my grandfather's confidant. I think that's a nice word. And during these years when she was collecting, she was literally competing with Peggy Guggenheim. And they did not admire one another or get along too well. But it's sort of interesting that the Guggenheim is the beneficiary of two wonderful individuals, the Baroness Hilla Rebbe and Peggy Guggenheim, both of whom are women and who did so much for us. That's a picture of Hilla and my grandfather at his plantation down in Yemassee, South Carolina. This is the Museum of Non-Objective Painting, which was at 24 East 54th Street. And I think that my grandfather rented this space on June 1st, 1939. And that's where, before this museum was built, that's where a lot of the collection was shown. Prior to that, I can remember my grandfather in the Plaza Hotel. He had quite a large suite there, and many of the original paintings hung there. This is the Kandinsky exhibition in 1945 in that same location. I was in the Army that year and missed that. This is Frank Lloyd Wright, as you all know, with a model of this museum. I remember seeing that model in the plaza when he came in to show it to the Baroness and to my grandfather, and I can remember how excited they were. This, I believe, was in 1950. No, it was in the middle 50s. That's a picture of him taken in 1959, which is the year he died, and it's also the year that we opened. My grandfather, as I said earlier, died 10 years earlier, 1949. And this building opened, as I said, in 1959. When Hilla became impossible, the board asked her to step down as a director, kept her as a trustee, and engaged the services of James Johnson Sweeney in 1952. So he was our second director. He did a fabulous job of collecting. He filled gaps in the collection before he left in 1960. And some examples of what he acquired for us. Here is the Cezanne, 1954. It is, I understand that the museum paid $100,000 for this back then in 1954. That was considered to be a lot of money in those days. This is a Brock that he was responsible for acquiring, Miro. And he also acquired many examples of Pollock, de Kooning, Brancusi, Calder's, Max Ernst, Picasso's, and so forth. This is Tom Messer, who many of you may remember. He came to this country from Czechoslovakia, served as a director of another museum or two before coming here in 1961. He was the director here for 27 years. I was very lucky to be associated with him as president the last 20 years and prior to being president. He is still on our board of trustees. He is really responsible for our acquiring the Tannhauser collection, which, as you all know, is an incredible collection, as well as the Peggy Guggenheim collection. Both of these individuals were, as most major collectors are, not too easy to get along with, not too easy to entice into leaving them your collection. And Tom, of course, in addition to those major collections, acquired many works of art. He instituted very large retrospective exhibitions at this museum over the years, which were fabulous, and as well as single artist exhibitions. There's a Rothko, 1949, that he's responsible for, and the ones that I'm showing now are ones that he acquired. This is a Picasso that we acquired through the Justin Tannhauser collection. That was done in 1900. Van Gogh, that's also from the Tannhauser collection, 1889. That is the Brancusi Muse. Done in 1912. I have to credit, everybody has to credit Sweeney and Tom Messer for this beautiful sculpture. The reason for that is that there was a man by the name of Bulova who left this Brancusi to us. We were happy to have it, and a little time went by, and Mr. Brancusi's widow. Actually, she was not his widow because they were divorced when he died. She took the position that this Brancusi belonged to her, that he had no right to give it to us, that he didn't know anything about art or Brancusi, and that Brancusi was a friend of hers, and that she, in fact, had acquired it when she was married to him. Naturally, we struggled in court to retain the Muse, and we won, and then they appealed, and we won, and they appealed, and it went up to the New York State Court of Appeals, and we lost. And Tom Messer was absolutely in tears when they came to take it away. And he never forgot it. And many years went by, and the former Mrs. Brancusi, for one reason or another, sold it, and we reacquired it a few years ago. So I have to give both directors credit for having acquired that sculpture. This is a Giacometti, the nose, done in 1947, and this is a Pollock that we acquired through the Peggy Guggenheim collection. Now, I didn't say much earlier about Hilla Rebbe, but just a few examples of works that she acquired. This is a Clay, 1922. There's a P. Kandinsky, 1923. Modigliani, 1917. I remember that one when I was a little boy running around the Plaza Hotel. That made an impression. This is a Delaney, 1910. And this is a Kokoschka, 1915, that we acquired through the Nierendorf collection, which was during her directorship. There's a Franz Marc, 1911, and a Chagall. I mentioned Justin Tannhauser. This is Justin Tannhauser and his wife Hilla and Harry Guggenheim looking at a gallery, a model of a gallery that we were putting aside for their collection. Their collection has been a fabulous enhancement of ours. And Harry Guggenheim and I and Tom Messer spent a lot of time trying to keep Justin happy. And I think we succeeded more or less. And when he died, things got off the track a little bit with Hilla. And I'm happy to say that when Tom Krenz, our new director, came with us a year and a half ago, he repaired that relationship, which is so important to us. This is the inside of the Tannhauser collection. On the right is a Matisse, which we did not get from Tannhauser. This was the result of a swap with the Museum of Modern Art that Tom Messer accomplished prior to his retirement. This is a picture of some of the family. Peggy on the right, a fellow by the name of Oscar Strauss next to her, Joan Vandemal, myself, my mother, and my younger brother. Incidentally, my mom had three husbands, and Michael is the result of her second marriage. Out of all those marriages, there are only three kids, so everybody was pretty conservative. This picture was taken on the occasion of her collection being shown here at the Guggenheim in 1969. It was an important event because it was really, I think Harry said, "Come home, Peggy, all is forgiven." And, you know, they were cousins, and she had become a little less critical of the old conservative group back here in the United States, and it was during this visit that we really cemented the relationship whereby she left us her collection and her palazzo in Venice. Peggy and I got on quite well because Harry was very sick about the time this happened, and he told her that I was going to carry on and that she could trust me, and I'm so pleased that she did. I think it would have been interesting to have known her a little earlier in her life, but I really enjoyed the relationship. I remember one time in the garden and in Venice, she wrote me a letter that she was going to bury her dogs. She loved her little dogs in a certain area there. And she wrote me a letter and she said, "Promise me that you won't let Tom Messer destroy my graveyard for my dogs." And I assured her that as long as I was alive and had anything to do with it, that would not happen. And much to my surprise, maybe she didn't believe me, because when she died, her ashes were placed right next to the graveyard for her dogs. This is a picture of Tom Messer on the right and myself and Max Ernst on the occasion of a show he had quite a few years ago. I had just returned from seeing Peggy in Venice, and I thought that was something that would interest him since he'd been married to her. And I told him I'd just returned from Venice and I'd just seen Peggy. He said, "Peggy, Peggy who?" Now, these are some slides of the Palazzo. That's the Grand Canal. This is the roof of the Palazzo, which was an unfinished palace. I think a neighbor complained about the fact that it was just quite high enough. It would impede the view if it went any higher. This is from the Grand Canal, facing the museum. That's another view of it. That is the front entrance with the Mario Marini sculpture. That's Peggy's bedroom with the Calder bedstead that he made for her. That's used to be the dining room, and that's now space where we exhibit. And this is an example of some of the art in Peggy's collection. This is a Magritte, 1932. Speaking of Max Ernst, this is an Ernst that he did in 1940. This is a Picasso, 1937, and a Tanguay, 1937. This is a picture of the when Peggy died, which was around Christmas time in 1979. We took possession of the Palazzo, and this was the official opening in April. It was an awkward experience for me because, incidentally, that's Philip Rylands, who is still the director of the museum there. That's Tom Messer. And I don't remember who the others are. What was awkward was that Peggy had really not left much to her progeny. And at this dinner, of course, we had her family invited for the dinner that evening. And her son Sinbad was definitely disturbed over the fact that he took it out on me as though I was inheriting this collection. And obviously it had nothing to do with me, but he would look at me and think that I had something to do with her decision, which I really didn't. Quite frankly, I did feel, and I still feel, a little sorry for her grandchildren who really got very little. And in their view, if she had just sold one painting, it could have done an awful lot for them. So that was not a happy occasion for me personally, because I had very mixed emotions. One of the things we did when we first acquired the museum was to form a board, an advisory board for the Peggy Guggenheim collection. We were the new boys on the block. We knew very little about Venice, and we needed advice. And we formed a board, and these two people are Maria Pia Fanfani on the right and Claude Pompidou on the left, who is the chairman of our Peggy Guggenheim Collection Advisory Board. And we are working towards having 50 members of that board. We meet twice a year, once in Venice, once here or elsewhere. And people pay $10,000 for the privilege of joining, and then a couple of $1,000 a year on a continuing basis. And that's been a great success, and everybody enjoys it, and we've met in other places, which makes it quite exciting. This is the original design of the expansion, which, as you know, was revised. That's a side view from the 89th Street side. I knew that design was not going to fly when somebody referred to it as a tank of a toilet bowl. This is the current design. Uh, And there you can see how we were trying to show the city that we really were pretty small potatoes. People worried about our expansion when you see what was around us. I'm going to get to Tom in a second. I just want to say something about this expansion that's underway. Quite a few years ago, when we built the original annex, I was very much involved with that. William Wesley Peters, who is Frank Lloyd Wright's son-in-law, was our architect. And we had no problem from the city or the public or anybody else. Everybody thought it was just fine. We only built four stories because that's all we could afford. But Mr. William Wesley Peters talked me into putting in foundations strong enough so that someday when we could afford it and we went up, the foundations would justify that and we wouldn't have to go through that again. So when the time came, 5 years ago it's been, when we decided that we really must expand, to me it was phase two of something that had always been planned. And I was very surprised at the first meeting before the Board of Standards and Appeals that the chief witness for the opposition, the people who were opposed to our being permitted to expand and to build this structure, was William Wesley Peters. And he made the statement at that meeting that it was never envisioned by Frank Lloyd Wright that there would be a tall building on that site. So here's one person that is awfully glad that we persevered. We can understand people who live behind us having their views blocked. Progress does create problems, and nobody loves this museum more than we do. And we were made to appear in the press as though, you know, we just didn't care about Frank Lloyd Wright or the building. And as you all know, that's far from the case. I just want to say one more thing, and that is that I said earlier that Tom Messer was just the right man for his era. And I think that Tom Krenz, who will be speaking to you in a few minutes, is just the right man for the next quarter century. We're very, very lucky to have this young, dynamic man whom I will introduce in a minute if you have any questions. I've been asked to respond to questions if there are any. I can't see anybody, so yeah, that's better. Does anybody have any questions? Okay. I'm relieved. When Tom came on board a year and a half ago, he inherited a lot of headaches. The expansion headache that I've told you about, the fact that the original building, which is now 30 years old, is in need of renovation. Storage has been a terrible problem. Financial pressures have been a terrible problem. And he has hit the ground running, as I've said many times, and he has convinced the Board of Trustees, the wonderful staff that he inherited and that he has added to. He has impressed us with his vision. He has a global vision of our niche, which he, I am quite confident, will tell you about. Thank you very, very much.
You know, I feel a little bit like the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Hearing Peter's history of the Guggenheim and its development over the last 50 years, it occurred to me that I'm only going to be talking about things that I hope will come true. I hope to be able to influence the direction of this institution in a very positive way. I thought it might be useful, and I'm going to try to keep my comments very brief, to try to suggest, based on Peter's talk, something about the dynamic that is in place in the growth of an institution. You know, what you've seen here is that there is an extraordinary relationship in any museum between the art, the objects that come together under certain individuals' vision, the spaces that are made available for the display of that art. The Guggenheim began really first with a collection that was displayed at the Plaza Hotel. It then grew to a space that had been a used car dealership, as Peter pointed out, on 54th Street and Madison Avenue. You know, an interesting feature is that our current foundation offices, when they moved uptown from Lower Manhattan, happened to land at 54th and Madison at the same address. And from that used car dealership, which became a museum, first of non-objective art, the Guggenheim that now inhabits this space on 5th Avenue and 88th Street was built and opened in the 1950s. And that wasn't an easy process either. Sites were explored around Manhattan at one time. There was an expectation that this museum might be located further uptown. And indeed, the site itself had a great deal to do with Frank Lloyd Wright's design. And his design has had some influence on the development of the collection. You've also seen the Guggenheim expand to Venice. And in many ways, that may have been a unique feature, that is a unique feature of the institution. We are the only museum that I know of, an art museum in the world that actively operates on two continents, that operates two museums. But it may be that that move to Venice was a function of the fact that we weren't allowed, the foundation wasn't allowed to take Peggy's collection out of Venice and bring it back to New York. Because in the early 1980s, the late 1970s, the notion of operating a museum at such disparate locations was a difficult one, I assume, for Tom and the board. However, the opportunity to add such an extraordinary collection as Peggy Guggenheim's to the existing strengths of the Guggenheim collections was overpowering, and so an accommodation was made. We became an Italian foundation. We operate a museum at two locations. I came to the Guggenheim.